for you in the next 2 hours is that mind control is a valid subject. We can prove a good deal of its history and its postulates, and especially in this litigious climate when people argue that therapists and others are crazy for believing in things like mind control, it's my function to show that the subject has validation across several centuries and especially a rich history in this century. What I want to do is to use slides to illustrate my talk, and so if we could lower the lights, you'd be able to see the slides better, and let me begin. Can we, yeah. Great, let me see. All right. Naturally, the history of mind control begins with the proverbial hole in the head. This is the an illustration of a trephined skull, the first known medical intervention for mental illness. There are many such skulls that have been recovered from civilizations throughout the world, suggesting that trephining, which is, as you can tell, an early form of lobotomy, was well practiced by many ancient civilizations. The reason why the proverbial hole in the head here is important to us is that this was a therapeutic procedure built upon a medical philosophy, and the philosophy is one of possession. It seems to me that in many ways, as I'll suggest to you, these notions have come back again in the 20th century, and so I thought it appropriate to start with them now. The possession idea carried through well to the Middle Ages, when possession theories of mental illness were prevalent and cures based on them were equally as prevalent and indeed necessary. This is an illustration of medieval moon madness, and some of the dancing episodes that went throughout the Middle Ages. The treatment of choice was exorcism, which you see an illustration of here. If you look all the way over on the left, the woman being held by a group of men, there's a devil coming out of her head. This was, of course, the early equivalent of multiple personality disorder. And the notion of possession theory, the body being inhabited by other beings, is an important aspect of dissociation. The theory may have changed somewhat, but there is certainly a direct history from the possession ideas to the dissociation ideas that we experience today. The first real treatise, I think, in mind control, which brought together possession ideas into a textbook, is the Malleus Maleficarum, which is written in 1484. It's called The Witch's Hammer. And I was interested to note that in the latest issue of, I think, Newsweek magazine, with the cover story on the brain, there is a one-page description of the Malleus Maleficarum by a novelist who wrote a woman's novel based on its terms. The Malleus was used as a Bible for witch hunting, and it tells you how to identify witches and how especially to interrogate them and how to cure them, the cure usually being killing them. But the value of the Malleus, I think, is twofold. It is probably the second known textbook in history on cross-examination techniques, the first one being the Platonic Dialogues. And so we get in the Malleus a systemization of the knowledge of how to do interrogations to lead people to get confessions that you want them to give. And so in the history of mind control, it plays a very important role because this is the work that was used by the inquisitors throughout the Middle Ages and thereafter to obtain confessions, and indeed false confessions. The Malleus itself then was read by police departments centuries later and used as the beginning of the development of police manuals. Let me jump ahead a couple of centuries until last century, the 1800s, with the birth of psychiatry. And it perhaps is no surprise that there is a common link to possession theories and the birth of psychiatry, in that most psychiatric treatments had the same element of violence that we see in the Malleus and that we see in the Exorcism and beyond that. It's to cast the demons out. I'm going to run through a series of slides here, all taken from psychiatric textbooks, on the way in which people were treated. This one is an individual who was chained to a wall. And this is a form of a straitjacket, as you can see, where a person is tied directly to a drain pipe in the wall. Here is an early version of the straitjacket itself. It was believed that these people were inhabited by demons, and that in order to get those demons out, exorcism was replaced either with violence or with severe restraint. But a century ago, they also had something that we tend to consider as modern, but is not, shock treatment. The shock treatment done, however, was usually a different form than electricity, since they had not yet invented electricity. This is a water shock treatment, and another version of it appears here, where an individual is led blindfold on the platform. Suddenly the platform falls from beneath him, and he's dumped into a bucket of ice-cold water. This was intended to be shocking. Another form of shock treatment was to fire a cannon behind somebody without them knowing that was going to happen. Again, the idea was to use a form of violent cure because of a theory of violent possession. Interestingly enough, even electric shock has a history in antiquity. We did not need the development of electricity to have electric shock. The ancient Egyptians used to take a torpedo fish and slap it on the forehead of people who were possessed, and the fish would discharge an electric current. And that's the earliest record of electroshock treatment. This is a device that nobody can ever guess the importance of. It's an ovary compressor. And I'll leave it to your imagination to consider how painful it must be to have experienced it. Seclusion, in its worst form, is the wooden crib here. This is a form of containment in which you can see the person is totally strapped into a crib with no way to move. This, however, it was not the worst form of restraint. It took a leading psychiatrist to develop that. This is the rotating chair. A person could last only a few seconds in this chair without becoming nauseous and eventually losing consciousness. And then there was the tranquilizing chair. All of these devices were used in the late 1800s. The last two of them were developed by Benjamin Rush, a signer of the Declaration of Independence, and his face appears on the seal of the American Psychiatric Association as its founder. It's not my desire to criticize psychiatry here, but rather to make the point in terms of mind control that we began studying the human mind and mental illness with a theory of possession and a theory of cure based on violence. And from that, we'll see the various refinements. Perhaps the first of the refinements, and the one that's notoriously wrong, was the leading psychological theory of the 1800s, and that is phrenology, that you could measure the exterior of the brain, or rather of the skull, in order to understand the interior of the mind. And this is an illustration of a phrenologist's chart, that the theory being that there is a direct correlation between a person's characteristics as an individual and their skulls and the lumps and other aspects to be found on the skull. The theory, of course, is completely wrong, but it occupied a good deal of the 1800s and was the leading theory of psychology at that time. It led to further variants in terms of face reading. the importance of the theory is not that it was wrong, but rather that it led people to begin to try to measure internal states. And so from an erroneous theory, people began to look inside the brain to see how you can find external correlations with the brain. And we come across what I think is the great paradox in all of healing, and that is that the more you learn how to cure people, the more you learn how to harm them. And for every step forward in relieving mental illness, you can take a step backwards in causing it. And so for people whose interest is in control of the mind, their data comes from how to help the mind. And so there is no step forward that does not involve equally in the hands of malevolent people a step backwards. The idea of mind control turned more serious, however, and our concerns more contemporary when we come to hypnosis. This is Hypnos, the Greek god of sleep. Of course, hypnosis is not sleep, and so the name itself is deceptive as to the mechanism of hypnosis. But hypnosis began the modern era with Mesmer, whose theories were also wrong planetary magnetism affecting mental states and so forth. What Mesmer really happened upon without realizing it was the beginning of the idea of the laws of suggestion. And what he did is set up what's called a baquette. You can see here it's an oak tub from which iron bars extrude, and the French nobility would come and touch the iron bars, which were in the tub. The tub was filled with water with iron filings, and people would then have convulsive states, which were pleasant enough for them to repeat quite frequently. Some slides of the baquette. This was high society, not only treatment, but also entertainment. You can see at the left a woman has fainted. That was quite common. Here's a color slide of the same kind of event. Mesmer work was studied by a presidential commission, a king's commission. King Louis XVI appointed a special commission to study mesmerism. At the time, it was receiving rave notices from the public and condemnation from medical societies. Here's a cartoon at the time of animal magnetism. You can see the animal doing the hypnosis, and another cartoon debunking animal magnetism. The report that was issued on the work of Mesmer's student, Deslon, was highly critical. The commission found that there was nothing to the interplanetary theories and the magnetic theories, but they were then forced to explain why Mesmer got so many cures. And they attributed the cures to the power of imagination. And rather than study the power of imagination as a way to cure individuals, the commission left the issue alone, and it took 100 years for people to pick up that essential point that manipulation of the imagination could be used to manipulate the mind. The commission also issued a secondary report that was stamped eyes only, for the king's eyes only. And in that report, the commissioner said that there was an aspect of magnetism that was so dangerous that the practice should be stopped at once. It was a menace to morals, that the attraction that developed between the magnetizer and the subject being magnetized was so great that seductions were inevitable. And therefore, we have the first inkling of the relationship between hypnosis and hypnotic seduction in this secret report for the king's eyes only. Mesmer died in disgrace and in exile after the report appeared, and hypnosis, which was still called animal magnetism at the time, fell into disgrace, but not into complete abandonment. It wasn't until about 50 or 60 years later that James Braid, a Scottish physician, coined the term hypnosis and hypnotism, and it wasn't until about 50 years after that that hypnosis begins to be studied in a serious way, and the problems of mind control using hypnosis as the vehicle again resurface. The Victorians were interested in hypnosis because it was fun to be hypnotized. They lacked the joys that we have, such as Geraldo, and so they had to entertain themselves by using hypnosis for their parlor games. And you can see a man here drinking milk out of a saucer on the floor. He had just been hypnotized. And so stage hypnosis at the turn of the century, from the 1890s through the 1910s and 20s, was one of the most well-known and well-attended and lucrative forms of entertainment. Just a couple of artifacts from that period of time is a brochure from a stage hypnotism show. Walter Bodie, an English hypnotist, was perhaps one of the most famous of the stage performers. He had a hypnosis and electrical show. You can see on there a statement, "The Real Trilby." Going back to Svengali, we'll return to that in a moment. This is James Bodie. He lives on in history for a reason people don't remember anymore, and that is he was the inspiration for an extremely young comic who got his start by mimicking Bodie. And here's the young comic. Here's the two of them together. Bodie on the right and Charlie Chaplin on the left. And so Charlie Chaplin's career began by studying Bodie's mechanisms and his mannerisms on stage, and then making comedy of them. During the Victorian era, people's exposure to hypnosis was not only as a form of entertainment, but it seemed like a form of mind control as well. You could get people to do anything that you asked of them. You could have them be suspended between two chairs. You could even stand on them when they're suspended between two chairs. And you could do a lot worse as well. If you're sensitive, please don't watch the next two slides. This is an iron bar held by eyelids put into the eyelids of a subject. And this is a stage hypnotist in Georgia. And as if that isn't bad enough to suspend an iron bar from the eyelids, he took it one step further and then pulled a young woman on roller skates. So it's not always fun to be hypnotized. And some people have taken the idea of stage hypnosis, it seems to me, far beyond where it should be entitled to go. One of those people is Barry Konnikoff, who traffics under the name of Potentials Unlimited. In one of his later, he has self-hypnosis tapes, which were available all over the place. I've heard he's gone bankrupt now, and I certainly hope that's true. In his later round of tapes, he argued that women who have been sexually abused or raped deserve it because of what they did in prior lives. Now, the First Amendment perhaps protects that. On the other hand, there aren't words that would describe a person who would make money out of that kind of a theory, so I won't waste our time on him. I want to get back to the central theme of mind control, which starts with Jean-Martin Charcot, who was the foremost neurologist at the time. While the stage hypnotists were persuading people that minds could be controlled by hypnosis, the professionals were learning hypnosis as well, and they were learning it largely from a small group of people, the most influential of whom was Charcot. Charcot, as the greatest neurologist in Europe at the time, was frequently visited by kings and princes and certainly all of the most elite of the medical profession from around the world. And in his clinic at La Salpêtrière in Paris, he would demonstrate hypnotic phenomenon. He would, in his demonstrations, induce neurotic symptoms in people. People who came in with an inability to move one limb in hypnosis would be able to move that limb, but he would transfer the neurotic symptom to the other limb, and so he could create and destroy and eliminate and transpose neurotic conditions. And this was a remarkable demonstration, which impressed a number of people in the audience. But his theories were at odds with his major contemporaries, Liebault, who was on the left, and Hippolyte Bernheim, who was on the right. There was, in France at the time, this second school of thought about hypnosis. Charcot believed that people who could be hypnotized were hysterics, and that hypnosis was a form of hysterical dissociation. Bernheim, based on the work of Liebault and his own work thereafter, believed that hypnosis was a form of suggestion, and that the manipulation of suggestion did not need a former neurotic condition. Here's Bernheim. Bernheim and Charcot often appeared against each other in a series of criminal cases that appeared throughout France on the issue of the antisocial production of crime with hypnosis. A person who studied from both of these people and was influenced by both of them was Sigmund Freud. This is a picture of him on his wedding day, and a better known portrait of him in his old age, and then the infamous couch. In his London office, over the couch, Freud had a picture of Charcot doing the demonstration that I showed you a few slides back. Let me get to that. This was a picture that hung over the couch in Freud's office in England. Now, Freud was very much influenced by the hypnosis theories and worked with hypnosis for a year, but then abandoned it, and it wasn't clear why he did abandon hypnosis. Some theorists have argued, and I think correctly, that he was a lousy hypnotist, and that seemed to be true, and he couldn't, as a result, get deep enough trances to have effect on his patients. Other theorists have argued, and Freud's own writings tend to support a secondary hypothesis, and that is that Freud was scared of the seductive power of hypnosis, that the ability to move people into altered states of consciousness gave a feeling to the hypnotist of some such omnipotence that it was in itself seductive. And Freud wrote that in one of his patients, as soon as the hypnotic encounter had ended, she jumped up and threw her arms around him and hugged and kissed him. And he did not attribute that to his handsome demeanor. He said it must be some other force at work, and it so frightened him, he said, that he never used hypnosis again. And I think that he's harking back to the Mesmer Commission's noticing that there is a manipulative power in hypnosis that the subject may not be able to resist, but also the hypnotizer may not be able to resist as well. Bernheim, by the way, and Albert Mohl, a German hypnotist in the 1880s and 1890s, had already given the world the false memory syndrome. They called it retroactive hallucinations at the time, and they wrote quite openly in their works that they were concerned that through the power of suggestion, you could create an impenetrable witness for a court of law, that by hypnotizing somebody, you could induce them to tell a false story. That story would be impervious to cross-examination because the individual would sincerely believe in the truth of what he or she was saying, and therefore you would never be able to effectively cross-examine that person because they would continually insist on the truth of what they were reporting. And so by the early 1890s, the phenomenon of false memory had already been noted and been written about extensively, and its application to courts of law had already been written about. There is absolutely nothing new in the false memory issue. It is simply a failure to read the literature from 100 years ago. What's more important is, where are we going to go from now with false memory? And I think the answer is where we have already come from 100 years ago. The next step beyond false memory was the beginning to use these techniques deliberately for the purpose of mind control. And essentially, the first steps are taken by A.R. Luria in his institute in Moscow. and lure your reason that if you can get people to have false confessions with hypnosis, you probably could build affective complexes on those false confessions. In other words, you could not only get people to report things that never happened, you could get them to experience the entire range of emotions affiliated with those events. And so Luria and his colleagues in Moscow in the 1920s began doing research on developing neuroses built upon the implantation of false memories. That work was replicated in the 1930s by Milton Erickson, Lawrence Kuby, and others who verified the truth of what Luria was reporting. Now, Luria's work was not merely academic. It had its operational uses in the next decade in the Moscow show trials, which are an extremely important historical event for our purposes. During the Moscow show trials, Stalin purged his old enemies. Now, one way you can do that is simply have them disappear, or you could have public executions. It is generally true throughout histories that regimes try to improve their own legitimacy by discrediting their predecessors. Stalin's way of doing it was to put on trial all his former friends. And what was different about the Moscow show trials is that when these defendants went on trial, they not only confessed to a series of crimes and sins they could not possibly have committed, but they begged to be shot as enemies of the state. Some recent books on the prosecutor's role in programming during the Moscow show trials have added some new information to our understanding of them. It was at this point that American intelligence agencies began to take notice of the mind control potential that seemed to be apparent from the Moscow show trials. The actual paper record, though, is hard to trace from the 1930s, easier to trace from the 1940s. And the trial that ultimately set the CIA off on its investigation of mind control was the trial of Cardinal Mindszenty. Mindszenty was a staunch anti-communist who was then arrested by the communists and put in the Andrássy Street prison in Hungary. 6 months later, he was put on trial. And as his predecessors a decade before, he confessed to crimes and sins that could not possibly have been true. These are a series of slides showing him at trial. The experience of Mindszenty was so frightening to American intelligence agencies that they began to investigate whether or not the Soviets possessed some new form of mind control unknown to the West.